This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. In 1981, Janine Jones was a nurse working at the Bexar County Hospital when there was an unusual high number of babies dying for mysterious reasons. Other nurses noticed that these strange deaths were happening, and numerous other near-death events happened when Jones was working. The medical examiner or anyone else from outside the county hospital, they were not informed, but Jones was given a glowing recommendation and allowed to go work for a new pediatric clinic in Kerrville. There, the pattern followed her. But here, the authorities took action and charged Jones with the murder of 15-month-old Chelsea McLennan. She was convicted and sentenced to 99 years in prison, but now she's due to be released in March. Nico LaHood, Bexar County District Attorney, is now working to keep that from happening, and he's working to convince Jones to convict Jones of other child murders. We're joined by DA LaHood, Jason Goss, the Bexar County District Assistant District Attorney. Also with us is ProPublica senior reporter Peter Elkin, who covered this case when it first broke for Texas Monthly and wrote the book, The Death Shift, Nurse Janine Jones and the Texas Baby Murders, and he continues to break news in the Jones story. You can call into this. This is a community conversation. The number is 210-614-8980. What questions or comments do you have about the Janine Jones case? You could also email us at thesource@tpr.org, and you can tweet us at @tprsource. So welcome, DA LaHood, and also Assistant District Attorney Goss. We appreciate you coming in here today. So, Nico, tell me why this case, what does it mean to you?
Well, I mean, I start from the position, David, that I believe children are a gift from God, right? I think they're precious and they're our future. And I have four children. I've been blessed with four children, my wife and I. And children's lives matter. There's no doubt about that. And when you talk to these parents, and I've had the privilege under bad, horrible circumstances to talk to the parents of the children that we're trying to protect and stand up for, you see the pain on their face. You know, a parent never really gets over it. There's no closure, as people say. You and I were talking about off air that I've experienced that with the loss of my brother. In 1996, I saw my parents go through the loss of a child and what that does to the fabric of a family. And so when you meet with these family members, Jason and I and Jay and some of the other team members, I mean, you saw the bittersweetness in the sense of they couldn't believe that this is really going to happen, that there could be an opportunity where their child's life matters and that they're going to be accounted for. There were a lot of tears. There was a lot of emotion. You never get over it. I just believe you reached certain levels of peace in your journey. And so I think this is one of those steps in hopefully them finding that peace. And then also holding, in my opinion, a very evil woman accountable for stealing precious babies from this community and from families.
Peter Elkin, ProPublica senior reporter, you've been covering this case. You've even interviewed Janine Jones. Talk about her. What was your impression of her?
Well, she's a woman who, until recently, as we discovered, and we'll get to that in a minute, was adamant that she had never done anything wrong to harm children. And she was quite spellbinding as she told the story of how it was doctors and nurses who had messed up and were irresponsible and were responsible for the deaths and emergencies of kids. There was absolute certainty in her tone and her attitude that she had done nothing wrong. And that was the case when I interviewed her in a trailer home in San Angelo when she was first under suspicion but hadn't been yet indicted. And it was the case when I interviewed her in prison 4 years later when she was quieter but just as adamant that she had done nothing wrong to harm children.
So you're alluding to this letter where to the Texas nursing regulators saying that basically admitting some sort of guilt?
Yes. I mean, throughout this entire time, most importantly, during her criminal trial, she was tried once for murder and once for injury to a child. Murder in the case in Kerrville, injury to a child, and the one episode where she was tried back then for her San Antonio conduct. She was convicted in both cases, but in both of those trials, she pled not guilty and was convicted. And then in interviews with the press, not just me, but others at the time, and then with me in prison, she continued to insist that she was absolutely innocent, had done nothing wrong. Then, just recently, we discovered that she had written a letter to the Texas Board of Nursing in 2011, which was then finally getting around to revoking her nursing license because of the prospect that she might be released on parole, on mandatory release. And they notified her of the proposed action to revoke her license, and she wrote back an extraordinary letter in which she said, "I will take this opportunity to apologize to the board and to the nurses it represents for the damage I did to all because of my crime. I look back now on what I did and agree with you that it was heinous, that I was heinous." She didn't explicitly say, "I killed this child or that child," but she certainly was making an admission, and it was an extraordinary thing for her to have done it there and to have finally done it.
I know that the district attorney team, you can't talk about the case specifically, and there's some things you can't address, but I'm going to ask you some questions anyway, and if you can bat it down, please go ahead. But so, Jason Goss, how important is the discovery of this letter?
You know, I think it's important. Any kind, our whole purpose here in opening up what we were doing and talking about what we were doing and the fact that we're investigating Jeanine Jones was to get that type of information, was to get something that somebody had or that somebody could find that would get us further information and get us further down the road to holding her accountable for every baby that she killed. And so, you know, in terms of a letter that states that she was heinous and references the time before 1994, which is the time period we're focused on, the crime that she's committing and the damage she's done because of her crime, I think it's hugely important because, you know, and like Peter said, up until that point, we had never known that she had ever confessed at all or even talked at all about the fact that she was guilty.
And I can say this, David, you know, that wasn't our home run. I mean, we were moving forward on these cases without that letter, but the letter definitely doesn't hurt our position, right? It's affirmation to what we believed and what we believe the evidence we're going to have to present to a jury at a future date will show. So it definitely helps us. We're glad for it, and I really have to commend Peter for his tenaciousness and consistency and following up and you know, providing information to us because this is such an old case that he was extremely helpful to us in our process.
How hard are you fight to make sure that this letter is admissible?
Well, we want it all in. We want to give nothing and take everything, right? In 300, they say that it's true in trial. It's true in anything. You will step into a ring, a basketball court, a football court, field. You want to give nothing and take everything. So we're going to do everything ethically. We're going to do everything legal. But we believe this is something that should be before a jury, and we're going to argue like hell that it should be. And we believe the rules of evidence will allow that. But we'll take that up with the judge at the right time. And
Peter? You wanted to add?
Yeah, I just say, David, it is extraordinary. There's no question that Nico and Jason and Nico's office was pursuing this before the letter surfaced. They had brought charges before the letter surfaced. And in doing so, they were doing something that the DA back in the early 1980s, who had investigated the case for 2 years and thrown a tremendous amount of manpower and cost and resources at trying to bring a murder charge against Jeanine Jones, the DA had essentially folded up his tent after deciding that, one, it was going to be extremely difficult to prove a murder case, and two, coming to the conclusion that she was going to be behind bars for the rest of her life anyway, because she had gotten a 99-year sentence. That premise, of course, turned out to be wrong, and when people began to realize that she might actually get out, there was a growing pressure to try to bring a new murder charge against her, and DA LaHood's predecessor looked into it and, you know, basically concluded it was too difficult to do, and it certainly is a difficult thing to do.
And I believe that was Millsap at the time.
No question, they made the move to go for it before the letter surfaced.
Okay, all right, and so we're going to continue the conversation when we come back from the break. The number is 210-614-8980. Have you been personally affected by this case? Do you remember when the news broke in the 1980s? This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. We're talking about the saga of convicted baby killer Jeanine Jones. This case has dramatically resurfaced here in Bexar County as it's come to be known that she will be getting mandatory probation in March. And people are saying this woman is still dangerous. She belongs behind bars. And District Attorney Nico LaHood is trying to make sure that happens. So DA LaHood, when other district attorneys, we just heard from Peter, the reporter from ProPublica, said they thought this case was unwinnable, that they weren't going to try, and talk about how you made that decision that you are going to try.
Well, anything worth achieving is going to be difficult, right? If we didn't do things just because they were difficult, I don't think anybody would do anything in this world. So, of course, it's difficult. I don't want to be disrespectful or begrudging on my predecessors, but I think Peter was alluding to that my predecessors believed that we just couldn't we didn't have enough to go forward. And I said during the campaign that I was going to do my best ethically and legally to try to make sure that this woman takes her last breath behind bars, because that's what justice calls for.
But basically, you have no choice. I mean, you really have to take it. I mean, she's going to be released, and you just can't throw your hands up. You got to take your shot.
Well, I have a choice, but I wanted that choice. I mean, it's like I want the opportunity to hold her accountable. There's no reason why this woman should set free. Remember, you mentioned we're leading to a 1977 mandatory parole law that was in effect at the time that she had a trial. Ironically, it changed 3 or 4 years after she was convicted, but she was grandfathered in. So she got a 99-year sentence. Now, let that settle in. The jury gave her the max. They saw that she had a depraved heart. I call it a seared conscience, just an evil woman. And like I said earlier, if they could have given her the death penalty, we have reason to believe that they would have given her that. They said that after. And to get out in 33 years of a 99-year sentence is not justice. So it's not being overzealous. It's doing what's right, because these babies matter. You're talking about the whole fabric of families have been changed forever because their precious baby was stolen from them in a horrific way. And, you know, she's suspected, not accused, of anywhere between 47 and 60 baby deaths. Now, we say suspected because we look at her work times and when she was at different places in this hospital, and the deaths increased astronomically. I mean, it makes no sense. And so that's why people, when we're asked that all the time, is why do you say she's suspected of 47 to 60 baby deaths? It's because of when she worked, how many babies she had access to, and then the number of babies that either code blued, meaning they almost died, or passed on under her care or around her care. So, yes, it's a difficult case, but it's not an impossible case. And if I didn't think, number one, that she was absolutely guilty of these crimes, then we would not have presented them to a grand jury. And if I didn't think we could present the evidence to a jury of 12 and get a conviction, we wouldn't be moving forward either.
Do you think Jeanine Jones is still dangerous?
I can't speak to that. All I know is that she should spend every last breath behind bars until she takes her last one.
I mean, it should be an important factor in deciding how we should treat a case like this, because her continued endangerment to society and those around her, it should be something that this is not vengeance. This is about protecting society.
There's no vengeance here. This is justice. I mean, this has nothing to do with vengeance. I mean, she'll get her true judgment day, I believe, when she stands before the Lord. That's not about that. It's about if a woman is suspected, an individual is suspected of 47 to 60 deaths, and she was only convicted on one death and one injury to a child, which is not the 47 to 60 suspected deaths, that's not justice. So even if she was going to, if she already had a life sentence and she wasn't getting out, justice would call for her to be accountable for every child that was taken. And my instructions to our team was, try to make every child's life matter. I mean, don't leave any child behind. If the evidence supports a presentation to a grand jury, then we're going to present them.
Peter Elkin, when you were interviewing Jeanine Jones and the San Angelo trailer park, there were suspicious activity there.
Yes, there was. She had she was living there with a kind of group of supporters that she kind of taken under her wing.
She had like her own little kind of cult going on.
A little bit, yes, and one was another nurse who had been kind of her wing person throughout her time, both in San Antonio and in Kerrville when she worked at the clinic there, and then there was a young mother, unwed mother, and her child, and both the young unwed mother and her child separately were rushed to the hospital in San Angelo from the trailer home with medical problems, with breathing issues, when Jeanine Jones was with her, and. You know, we don't know exactly what happened there, but it sure was a strange coincidence. And there's a reasonable theory there is that she was trying to show that these things just happen sometimes. Well, they don't happen statistically very often. I mean, one of the extraordinary things about this case is in San Antonio, after everything all unfolded, after it was clear that there were kids harmed in San Antonio and in Kerrville, and it became public and it was under investigation, the prosecutors in San Antonio commissioned a Centers for Disease Control report. They did a study of what happened in the pediatric ICU, essentially looking at it like an epidemic. And they discovered that kids under her care, kids who were there in the ICU in the 3 to 11 shift, were 25 times as likely to suffer an arrest when she was on duty. And they were 10 times as likely to die.
They call that the death shift.
They called that the death shift. And they were doing that... that's another extraordinary thing about this, which is why, to me, it was worthy of doing a book and not just an article for Texas Monthly, albeit a long one which addressed these issues too, but why I wanted to go back and write more. Because there were overt suspicions, overt beliefs, lots of evidence to think something terrible was going on in the ICU. And nurses and doctors brought it to the attention of the administration of the medical school and the hospital, and they were unwilling to bring it to the authorities. Instead, they conducted a secret investigation. They brought in outside doctors, and they came up with a pretext to get rid of Jeanine Jones, which was to upgrade the ICU where she worked to an all-RN nursing staff. She was just an LVN. And so they got rid of her and the other five or six LVNs under that pretext, and they sent all of them, including her, off with a good recommendation, a letter of recommendation. And she then went off and worked in a pediatric clinic in Kerrville and harmed kids under her care there and killed one of them. And that's where the murder that she's already been convicted of.
So, Peter, you're saying that the Bexar County Hospital was engaged in an active cover-up of someone that they suspected of killing babies, and they allowed her, enabled her to go work elsewhere where that deadly pattern continued.
In essence, yes. They had every reason to notify the authorities and failed to do so. And in fact, even when the news broke in Kerrville that a child had been harmed under her care, that other kids had been hurt under her care, that the pattern had resumed, the pattern they knew about, they had a hospital committee meeting with top-level doctors, and they were discussing what to do about this. And I have the notes about this in my book, and this is just one internal memo of this sort. There's a whole litany of this behavior. The notes were say, and this is January 1983, before she's been charged, but they decided not to come forward with what they knew. And they said the committee in general recommends judicious silence on the issue. To me, that was just a ringing phrase and quite extraordinary that, you know, here it's happening again, and they don't come forward.
After Jeanine Jones was convicted, there was an order for Bexar County Hospital District to hang on to all of its medical records, yet they shredded tons of paperwork that could have been enlightening about what happened with Jeanine Jones when she was there, Peter.
It's a little unclear to me exactly how critical that information was. I think Nico and Jason have a sense of that themselves because they've tried to go back and reconstruct and gather the medical records and have been unable to find stuff. There's no question substantial stuff was shredded. The hospital insisted at the time that it was part of a routine process and it wasn't the relevant records involving her. But it is certainly the case that now, all these years later, the records involving these kids, a lot of critical ones, can't be found.
So, Nico LaHood, District Attorney, can you say if the destruction of this evidence has been a problem for you?
I mean, obviously, we don't have some evidence available to us. And the problem that we have is there's so much time that has gone by, and the people that were in charge back then are no longer, to my knowledge, Jason, I think we confirmed that they're no longer alive. So we're dealing with people that have passed on. So, I mean, I can tell you this, that if I was the DA back then, or if there was a current situation going on now and there was people that needed to be held accountable for doing something that either obstructed some type of investigation or violated a penal code, I don't care who they are, they would have been held accountable. End of story. It's just that simple. Lady Justice wears a blindfold. She doesn't selectively lift it up whenever she wants to. But so we are dealing with situations where the evidence is not available to us, and we've dealt with those challenges. Jason and our team, and Jason can talk briefly about some of that stuff. I mean, it's just been, he's worked overtime. I really want to take a moment just to commend him and Jay and some of these other guys. But Jason worked after hours. He runs a court, has his regular docket, and worked for over a year, keeping me updated with Larry DeHaven, an investigator that worked on this initially. And we're here because of the hard work of so many people in our office working together synergistically.
Go ahead, Jason.
Thank you. As far as the destruction of the records, you have 47 to 60 babies, and I think that we're pretty confident that we're not going to be able to bring 47 to 60 cases for that reason. If we had the medical records of these children, I think that would be a different proposition. But I think that there's two. What Peter's talking about was there was a destruction of what they called non-relevant stuff at the time. There was also, after the DA, my understanding, after the DA got done with the investigation, gave a lot of these records, the hospital records, back to the hospital. and who was, they were in the process of civil lawsuits and some other things going on, and those were destroyed. And I know that because we've tried to get them, and they're gone. And the hospital has told us they have no records now. So there's a lot of records, medical charts, which are vital to some of these cases that we can't get. Now, in all these cases, we don't need medical charts because we have other evidence. But in the cases where we did need medical charts, that's vital evidence that we don't have anymore.
Is there evidence, is that medical evidence in the grand jury documents that were at the time?
I mean, well, we're not going to talk about, with all due respect, what we presented to the grand jury, nor can we, by the way.
Or the old grand jury, the initial one from 1981, 82.
I'll let Jason speak.
Yeah, so what we do have, which is great, is we do have, and one of the things that the investigation back then with the DA that did a fantastic job is they put so many of these witnesses in front of the grand jury and talked about these medical records with those witnesses, and we have the transcripts of that. And so we do have an idea in some of these cases what those records, what they said, because the people are talking about them contemporaneously while looking at them, which that's information, especially because a lot of the people who were interviewed are still alive. That's information that's been very important for us.
Will you be looking for physical evidence from the children who died? Will you be exhuming their remains?
There were exhumations that were done back in 1984 of several children with the consent of the parents, and at the time those babies did not have enough tissue that they could test, and so I think right now anything's possible, and I think if Nico believes that that's something that we need to have and vital evidence we need to have, we'll definitely do it, but I can't see us exhuming children at this point.
DA, you want to say anything about that?
Well, I mean, we're going to follow the evidence and the truth wherever it leads us. I mean, that is kind of the culture in the office now. It's just wherever we just have to be militant about following truth and evidence. So if there's evidence that we believe in good faith and ethically that we need to present to a grand jury to hold her accountable for another baby's death, then we'll cross that bridge when we get there, and it would be something that would be viable. Right now, we're just not at that point. So it's viable. Everything's on the table that's legal and ethical. But right now, we feel we have enough with these cases and possibly more. The investigation is still open. We're still working.
How high of a priority is this in your office?
Well, we've put together a team. I mean, it's a priority. I mean, the idea of a serial killer getting back on the streets and not being held accountable for many, many deaths and bringing destruction onto communities, I mean, I think it shocks people's conscience. I mean, like I said, as a daddy now, it would shock my conscience. And people, I mean, I'm telling you, when you talk to these parents that we've met with, it's
even though it's 35 years ago, they still feel it today.
Well, Dad, you don't ever, you know, my mom says, she goes, mijo, as you know, is a term of endearment in Spanish, right? My brother passed on, and he's in heaven, but in August 15th, 1996, he left us. And my mom has found peace. You know, she's a grandma now, and she loves being a grandma, and she's found peace in her faith and her walk. But she goes, mijo, I'm going to have seasonal depression. I'm a mom. I'm never going to stop loving your brother, and I'm going to see him again. It's just not today, right? So I'm going to have seasonal depression, and I'm going to deal with it, but I have found peace.
That times 60.
Yeah.
Or
I mean,
more.
Different families, 47 to 60. Right. And we've met with these families, and you see the tears, and it's always an emotional meeting with them.
Okay. All right, we're going to continue the conversation after this break. We've got some callers that we want to get in on the conversation. The number is 210-614-8980. We're talking about Janine Jones, the killer nurse. She killed babies and convicted of at least one baby that she killed here in Kerrville. And there could be more convictions coming. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about convicted baby killer Janine Jones. She's expected to be released from prison on March 1st, but at that time, she will be transferred to the Bexar County Jail, and where she will be put on trial eventually for murders that she's also suspected of committing while she was a nurse at the Bexar County Hospital back in 1982. With us to talk about that is District Attorney Nico LaHood, his Bexar County Assistant District Attorney Jason Goss, and also with us is Peter Elkin. He's a senior reporter for ProPublica, author of The Death Shift, Nurse Janine Jones and the Texas Baby Murders. Are going to their phones now. The number is 210-614-8980. We're joined by Ron English. And Ron, welcome to The Source. And Ron, you say you knew Janine Jones.
Yes, sir. First of all, hello, Peter. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, thank you, Ron.
Nice to hear your voice
again. It's been a few years.
Yes, yeah, quite a few years. I'm a little older now than when you met me. Yeah, I was engaged to be married to Janine. And, you know, it's a long story how it happened, but, you know, it's in Peter's book, Death Shift. I don't want to make any judgments about what, you know, about Janine. All I can tell you is that when we were engaged to be married, it was a 2-year engagement, I began to realize that there was something pathologically wrong with her, lying and things like that. And then I noticed an obsession with medications, particularly my dad. He was a heart patient, and she would get a little carried away with some of his heart medications. But as far as Janine was concerned, I don't think that she ever really maliciously intended to murder any of those children. I think, as Peter and I once talked about in the interview in the book, Janine had a hero complex. And I noticed that with her around the house and things like that, she's like, oh, look what I did. I saved your dad. Oh, I saved my son. And she wanted this type of narcissistic attention, if maybe is the word, I don't know. But then after she was convicted and sent to prison, we were in correspondence with each other for about 2 years. And I've lost all the letters that she sent me, but I just find that there's some really tremendous complexities here, and it certainly doesn't negate the fact that so many people lost these children. Since I met Peter, I became a certified teacher, and you know, my heart goes out to these children, and don't think it hasn't haunted me for 37 years. But I just wanted to make that comment. And I know when she was arrested, she told in her deposition with Ron Sutton, the DA at Kerrville, she had stated that I was killed in an automobile accident in California. And that's when I met Peter, because I read the phone after I had 50 phone calls that day wanting to know I was still alive. Yeah, I am. Why? I found out. And that's where it all kind of, that's how I got involved with Peter in the book. So I don't know if you have any questions. I'll happily answer.
So Ron, you knew Janine Jones pretty well. It seems like she was a master manipulator. Is that true?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it took me several years taking psychology courses and various things like that to absolutely understand what we would colloquially call today a control freak.
But she was able to get people to do things that normally they wouldn't do?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there was no doubt about that.
Knew how to play people?
And she had, she really knew how to do it, and she had this incredible charm to her. I know that's when I first, you know, saw her and asked her out, and I said, you know, I mean, she was just really dynamic and, quote, fun to be with. But I guess that's how they all start. But, she was. She was a master manipulator.
And what kind of... So you say that she really wasn't trying to kill children, but she was trying to become the hero that saved children. But obviously she had no qualms about using children's lives as something to play with.
Right. Exactly. And as long as she could be the hero, and of course... Even before she got her nursing license, you know, I would tell her, Janine, you're playing with medications you don't know anything about. And that was just totally, she just, you know, she ignored it and said, I know what I'm doing. And, you know, obviously she didn't. But she didn't really care, as long as she could be the hero.
Peter Elkin, do you have any questions for Ron English?
No, we covered a lot of ground many years ago, and I actually have a lot of those letters that you're recalling, Ron, and have discussions of those in the book as well. You had an extraordinary relationship with her, and quite a window into her personality. I just add a little addendum to the charm notion. She was a compelling personality. But certainly one very sort of rough-hewn and rough and tumble, to say the least, in her kind of magnetism. So a lot of people found her dynamic. Some people found her dynamic, and she's a very strong personality. A lot of people found her offensive and overbearing, to put it mildly.
Mr. English, I mean, with all due respect, this is Nico LaHood. With all due respect, and I really appreciate you calling in, I understand the hero syndrome. Richard Jewell, who was accused in 1996 of the Olympic bombing, the FBI said he had a hero syndrome to create his own problem so he could save the world. Well, obviously,
but he was innocent.
He was actually innocent, correct. Thank you for pointing that out, David. But he was actually innocent. But she saw the effects of... Well, she obviously sucked at being a hero. Can we agree? So she saw the effects of her playing games with other people's lives, and she continued to it. So she had a conscience disregard. She had a seared conscience. And Shakespeare wrote, Shakespeare wrote, "The Prince of Darkness is a gentleman." So her charisma doesn't influence me one bit. Matter of fact, it goes to me into her deception and wickedness. That's my opinion, and I think the facts support it.
Any reaction?
No, I totally agree with you, because that's what I was saying. This was my observation of her then, and over 37 years, you know, I've come to this realization that you're saying, sir. And, you know, I must admit that it took me over 10 years to get out of denial with her.
So, Ron English, if you had a chance to talk with your former fiance, Jeanine Jones, and how did y'all break up?
I just basically began to realize that she was a pathological liar. There was just too many things that I couldn't handle, I couldn't deal with. And like Peter said, the overbearing personality, I really didn't realize what a, quote, evil person she was slash is.
So eventually the scales fell from your eyes and you saw her for what she was. But what would you tell her now if you had a chance to talk to her?
I would just very simply say, Jeanine, are you still in denial about this? I would really like to hear her words now. You know, compared to this letter I heard, you know, before I called in, I was absolutely shocked at what Peter, you know, said about that 2011 letter. And I'm debating whether I want to see her or not. I really don't know. I know I've all of a sudden resurrected myself from the grave, from the deposition in Kerrville, but I said, okay, hey, I've live my life. Who cares now?
Ron English, former fiance for Jeanine Jones, convicted baby killer. Thank you so much for calling in and help us understand her a little bit more. Appreciate you calling in, sir. So let's go to another caller with Richard. And Richard, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you, sir. Well, before Ron even called in, I'm not a mental health professional, I came to the conclusion that she had something wrong with her. I mean, for, you know, 40 to 60 children, I mean, there's something has to be wrong. And I know that you're not professionals that could to come to some sort of conclusion or even have very many ideas about this, but I know that police officers and military professionals and even government officials, professionals who deal with children, they get some sort of background check, you know, they get some evaluations, and sometimes when they go through a difficult time, they get a mental evaluation. Is this something that we should do for our medical professionals, to prevent the hero complex or the God complex?
Okay.
Or even to find out if, you know, maybe there's something underlying in the back, you know, something in their past that would prevent them from being a good medical health professional.
Okay, Richard, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. So should steps be taken? Should at least people be aware that this type of thing does exist and that that people are capable of acts like this, Nico?
The answer to that is obviously yes. How do you do it is the second question. How do you do it? Because a lot of people and a lot of professions that do screenings are just that. They're screenings. There are just a number of questions, and you're relying on the veracity of the person giving the answer. And then is it really in-depth, a screening versus a true analysis? I mean, so absolutely, if you have someone that looks at the world differently than we do and is not going to perform their duties in a safe manner and has maybe some ulterior motives, we obviously want to know that.
Right, but Peter Elkin, it seemed like one of her defenses was that this is such a crazy, indefensible, inconceivable act. Why would anyone do it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of her defenses, and another thing that, you know, in fairness, contributed to the total disbelief in the face of a huge amount of circumstantial evidence and direct accusations in the Bexar County Hospital, was that, you know, it seems so improbable that someone who cared for sick kids and was extremely emotional whenever they got sick and when they died, and professed passionate concern for their welfare. To a number of nurses, supervisors, it seemed inconceivable that any medical professional would deliberately harm them, and that in particular this medical professional, this woman, would deliberately harm them.
Is that because she put on such a big show whenever any child died?
She did indeed. She did indeed. She sobbed. She was in tears. One case, she would hold the baby's body and cradle it, or in some cases, actually took it down to the morgue herself. There are all sorts of bizarre episodes involving her that I talk about in the book. And by the way, on the issue of with the really interesting question of how should we screen, what should we do? I think as a practical matter, I'm sure it's very difficult to screen every single nurse or person, medical caretaker, that is licensed. But having said that, there's a lot in Jeanine Jones' early history that should have sidelined her from taking care of kids. It should have gotten her fired long before any of this happened.
Okay, we'll talk more about that when we come back from the break. I want to know what those things are. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Our line is 210-614-8980. We'll continue after this one-minute break. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Today, we're taking a deep dive into the story of baby killer Jeanine Jones. She worked in San Antonio as a nurse at the Bexar County Hospital in the pediatrics unit. And during that time in 1981-82, a number of children, an unusually high number of children were dying. And apparently the suspicion is that it was at her hand. She was secretly giving these children injections of dangerous drugs in order to try to prop herself up as the hero who would resuscitate these children. But so many times she failed and these children died. Many families lost loved ones when this happened here in Bexar County. To tell us more about all of this, we're joined by Bexar County District Attorney Nico LaHood, Bexar County Assistant District Attorney Jason Goss, and what's also with us on the line is Peter Elkin. He is a senior reporter for ProPublica, the author of The Death Shift, Nurse Jeanine Jones, and the Texas Baby Murders. And let's get to a caller. Sonia is on the line. And Sonia, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, I had a question. I was wondering if the fact that she was an LVN instead of an RN could have contributed to the fact that she maybe didn't know how to take care of the babies, and that's why they died?
Oh, I don't think so. That doesn't excuse or explain any of her behavior. She was actually viewed technically as an extremely proficient nurse in terms of starting IVs and administering medical procedures. She prided herself on being able to run a code better than anyone, which is, of course, tragic given because she was in the middle of so many of them, which was no accident. But technically, she had the skills, the medical skills, equal to, and in view of many, greater than a lot of RNs. So I don't think that was a factor in it.
But also you write, Peter, that she would overstep her bounds.
Yes. And she acted, the RN is certainly always senior to the LVN, regardless of how inexperienced the RN may be. They act as the charge nurse, even if it's a brand new RN. And Jeanine Jones would assert herself very aggressively and say which kids she wanted to care for. She'd boss the LVN, the RNs around. She would intimidate them. And she'd also do that to some degree with even with young doctors. This is a teaching hospital which was staffed by residents and interns, and she often would just take charge, bowl her way in, and say, "This is the way things are to be done," and sort of describe the scenario, and sort of allow the sort of disasters to take place that way.
That's a red flag for me. I mean, all this overcrying. We look at situations all the time. If a spouse has passed away, how does the other spouse react and respond? Is it appropriate? What are, we look at the totality of the circumstance when we're looking at people's motives, because we have to, motives is not an element to a crime, but it also helps us figure out a crime and leads us in a direction and helps us get to what we call the mens rea, the intent of the person that is accused of a crime. So her being a bullish mentality, crying, taking baby, to me, that would have, if I was around back then, that would have been a red flag for me.
And Peter, you say she was fired from an earlier nursing job because of this behavior. And before we went to break, you were talking about other things in her life that may have indicated that she was not fit to work with children. What's that?
Well, I mean, in terms of, there were, first of all, two other jobs she had even before she got to the Bexar County Hospital, and she had very short tenures there. For example, she was at one hospital and where she worked in the cardiac intensive care unit, and there was a performance review done of her, which concluded, and there's a quote, "Ms. Jones tends to make judgments that she has neither the experience nor authority to make." And you know, she was then fired, ushered out basically in April 78 after that happened. You know, it was complaints from a patient that led to her termination. She had another job that was very short-lived. And then when she went to Bexar County Hospital, she did a lot of strange things, was insubordinate, left shifts when she was supposed to be on duty, was pushing drugs that she didn't have approval to push, all sorts of stuff that should have gotten her fired long before this, you know, sort of Jeanine Jones epidemic really kicked in the ICU and kids began dying in extraordinary numbers.
But even before her professional life began, she had a history of faking pregnancies and also illness. And it's now been reported that she has stage 4 kidney disease. Is that true? Do we know that?
Well, I'm going to leave it. Nico and Jason are better plugged into the state of her health care and in the prison system. I'll leave that to them.
But you do know, but Peter, that is true that she would fake illness and cancer?
Oh, yes, absolutely. No, there's no question. And this is, I mean, one of the huge issues is how do you explain her behavior, what this is all about? And I think a big element of this, and I've talked to experts about it, read articles about it, and wrote about it in my book, is I think she was was an example of Munchausen syndrome by proxy. And this was true indeed before she became a nurse, how she behaved as a parent, where she got a thrill out of being in the center of attention. And in particular, liked to be involved, be in the middle of medical procedures that were either done to her, which is Munchausen syndrome, or medical procedures that were done to people under her care, including her own kids and their patients, which is Munchausen syndrome by proxy.
Do we know if Jeanine Jones has stage 4 kidney cancer, Nico or Jason?
My understanding is that she did have some problems with her kidney. I don't know that it was stage 4 kidney cancer, but she has, that was years ago, and I think that she's recovered from that.
Well, yeah, I don't know how you... They don't know how you recover from stage 4 kidney cancer in prison. But please understand my heart. I don't care if she has it or not. That's not my point. I'll leave that to her medical professionals. Our job is to hold her accountable for what we believe is her stealing children from families and from this community. So like Peter said, she has faked. She has tricked everybody, bullied people. She's a master manipulator. She uses charm when she wants to, threats when she wants to, the bullish.
Sympathy,
bull in a china store. We have to divorce ourselves from all of that and really stay objective. Like I said, true justice will come when she stands before God. But on earth, on this side of heaven, justice calls for her to take her last breath from behind prison bars.
Let's go to Susan on the line. Susan, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. The last gentleman has it pegged, Munchausen, and who knows what else.
How do you know that?
I'm just going back to grade school. My sisters and I went to grade school with her, and she was a pathological liar, in my words, then.
Where was that?
That was in the 50s, early 60s.
What was the name of the school?
At Marshall High School. She had a really interesting, strange childhood. Absolutely.
Grade school, St. Anthony School. And... then after that, of course, we weren't involved, but each time her case came up, we wrote letters. Nick wrote the, and anybody involved, please don't let this person out. She's definitely dangerous. I don't know how she would get a job in a child care related service at this point anyway, but you're right on with it. It's very, very sad, tragic to those families. And I'm kind of in touch with that because my daughter works at university. ICU, she's a nurse specialist in the neonatal unit, and all I have to say.
All right, Susan, thanks for calling in. Susan knew Jeanine Jones back in the day when she was a child, says even today she believes that Jeanine Jones is still dangerous. Nico LaHood, when Jeanine Jones was put on trial, murder trial for the death of the Kerrville child, that trial had to be moved to Georgetown.
Williamson County.
Williamson County. Mm-hmm. Are you going to try to keep the trial here in Bexar County this time?
We're going to try. I mean, we'll try the case anywhere. But, of course, obviously, we want the trial to be here. But we'll wait for the time, and we're not going to assume that. I'm sure her defense counsel at some point will file a motion to change venue, and we'll resist it at the time. A judge will make a final decision, and we'll try the case in a barn, in a courtroom, any county in Texas, it doesn't matter, but we prefer it in Bexar County.
Some people might say you coming on our show today may actually be prejudicial towards a potential jury. Talk about why you decided to come on today to talk about this case.
I don't know why anybody would say that. Of course it's not. I mean, I have a practice in the office, and I think you know this, that we don't try cases in the court of public opinion. We have not spoken one bit about the evidence that we're going to present to a jury at a later date or on any one of these cases and what's really going on. We're talking in generalities. This has been such a huge, this has affected our community over the years so much, and the amount of children potentially involved is so great that there's a huge public interest. And so there needs to be as much transparency as the law allows and as strategy allows. There's nothing illegal or unethical about me talking about the evidence of the case. There's just a practice in our office that on no case do we try that in the court of public opinion. Due process holds true, and I think everybody, even Jeanine Jones, deserves due process. Her constitutional rights need to be preserved, effective assistance of counsel, right to a jury trial, all of them, not some of them. They apply to everybody. And so we're trying to respect that and honor that. And so we're going to lay it all on the line at the right time. But I think it's important to talk about it. People have questions. People don't understand. And people need as much answers as we can give them ethically and legally and strategically.
Peter Elkin, you've been covering this since the very beginning. Why have you hung with this story?
Well, I didn't hang with it all this. Well, two things. First of all, I didn't hang with it constantly throughout this period. I went on and
was
a business writer for Fortune magazine for 20 years and was doing other things. And it resurfaced when I learned that the DA, Nico and Jason Goss, were investigating this case and actually clearly about to try to bring new murder charges against her. And that happened just earlier this year. But I will say this is a story that has stuck with me for more than 30 years in a way that nothing I have ever written about before has. It's incredibly resonant, both her personality, how she did what she did, and the people that enabled her and allowed her to do what she did. I mean, it's really an extraordinary saga, and that's why I've always found it so compelling. And these latest elements of it are just the, yet another twist, an extraordinary twist and development in the whole tale.
Peter Elkin, he is a reporter, senior reporter for ProPublica, author of the book The Death Shift, Nurse Jeanine Jones and the Texas Baby Murders, which you've recently updated, right?
I have, and had it republished as an ebook because it seemed like the story was going to come back in a big way and was worth telling.
And Bexar County District Attorney Nico LaHood and Bexar County Assistant District Attorney Jason Goss, thank you so much for joining us and helping us understand Jeanine Jones a little bit better and your case. And we're going to be covering your case as it moves forward. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thank you so much for tuning us in.